These are the top stories. Iran rules out holding an informal meeting with the U.S. and the European signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal, reiterating that Washington must first lift all unilateral sanctions. The U.S. cites national interests as the reason for refusing to sanction Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Also in the headlines, thousands of Haitians take to the streets of the capital to demand an end to their president's term in office. Welcome. Iran has dismissed the EU's offer of holding talks with the United States in the framework of an informal meeting of the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said time is not ripe for such a meeting. Said Khatibzadeh added that the U.S. has not even declared its readiness to fulfill its obligations under the nuclear accord and the UN Security Council resolution enshrining it. The Iranian officials stressed that the implementation of the commitments cannot be subject to negotiations. Khatibzadeh noted that the path forward is very clear, stating the U.S. should first lift its illegal and unilateral sanctions against Iran. Meanwhile, a White House spokeswoman said the U.S. was disappointed at Iran's response, arguing that Washington is ready to engage in what she called meaningful diplomacy on the issue. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says the Biden administration's offer of talks with Iran is aimed at forging a new nuclear agreement and not lifting the sanctions on Iran.
If the invitation to talk was about a procedure that would lift the sanctions, then there would be some rationale to it. But that's not what I think the Americans are after. I think the Americans are after moving Iran step by step away from the original agreement so that they can reopen the field to renegotiate or to negotiate a new one. So, I imagine that when the Iranian government was approached by the intermediary to try to line up these talks, the question arose, what is it that you want to talk about? And probably they didn't get a satisfactory answer. And their reply was that, there's an agreement, and if you want to agree to the agreement, then do what you're supposed to do.
It's been a year since the United States signed a peace deal with the Taliban in Qatar, while Washington calls the peace deal a success. Others believe by signing the agreement, the U.S. accepted its defeat in Afghanistan.
On February 29th, 2020, the United States and the Taliban signed a peace agreement in Doha, Qatar. Under the deal, which was officially titled the Agreement for Bringing Peace to Afghanistan, it was agreed by the U.S. to withdraw all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan. Taliban also pledged to prevent Al-Qaeda from operating in areas under Taliban control and to hold talks with the Afghan government. The agreement came more than 19 years after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. It was after the September 11 attacks in 2001 when then-President George W. Bush ordered the invasion.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
American troops entered Afghanistan looking for Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, claiming the government of Afghanistan was sheltering him. They promised to drive out both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants. At first, just more than 1,000 U.S. soldiers were sent to Afghanistan. The numbers kept growing every year. While every U.S. government promised to end the war in Afghanistan, the flames of conflict became bigger.
This month, our combat mission in Afghanistan will be over. Our war in Afghanistan is coming to a responsible end.
I can tell you, after 19 years, we'd like to bring our young people back home.
The U.S. Central Command Combined Air Operations Center says the U.S. Air Force dropped a record number of 7,423 bombs on Afghanistan. More than 100,000 Afghans have been killed or wounded since 2009, when the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan began documenting casualties. After nearly two decades, the U.S. invasion has achieved very little. Violence still rages on in Afghanistan, with thousands of people getting killed each year. Washington did not manage to drive out the Taliban. Instead, the militant group now controls much of the country. 20 years of bloodshed amid what the U.S. government insisted to call nation building did not produce the political results Washington was after. That's why they stretched their hand to the Taliban for peace. American troops invaded Afghanistan to drive out the Taliban, but instead were forced to recognize them. The Doha peace agreement shows that America finally accepted the fact that Afghanistan's fate was never going to be determined by them. Afghans choose what's best for them without the help of foreigners.
At least five civilians, including a child, have been killed in a Saudi-led airstrike in Yemen. According to Yemeni media, the drone raid targeted a residential building in the western city of Hodeidah. Several others were wounded. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched their aggression against Yemen in March of 2015. That entailed both a military offensive and tight blockade. A campaign was aimed at overthrowing Yemen's Ansar Allah movement and reinstating the Saudi-backed former regime. That objective has not been achieved yet. The UN says nearly a quarter of a million Yemenis have died so far, more than a half of them from indirect causes such as lack of food. The White House has defended its move not to punish Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
People who are under the Crown Prince, and they are being punished. So isn't punishing them like punishing the hitman and not the mob boss who actually put out the hit?
Well, first, Anna, historically, and even in recent history, Democratic and Republican administrations, there have not been sanctions put in place for the leaders of foreign governments where we have diplomatic relations and even where we don't have diplomatic relations. And we believe there is more effective ways to make sure this doesn't happen again and to also be able to leave room to work with the Saudis on areas where there is mutual agreement, where there is interest, national interest for the United States.
The White House spokeswoman dodged a question as to why President Joe Biden has not honored his promise to, quote, punish senior Saudi leaders for the murder. Biden made the pledge when he was running for president. Jen Psaki instead said Biden would recalibrate U.S.-Saudi relations, and that means ending support for Saudi war in Yemen, addressing the human rights abuses of the kingdom. A newly released U.S. intelligence report says bin Salman approved the 2018 murder of Khashoggi. Political commentator Kevin Barrett says Saudi Arabia's lavish financial support for U.S. politicians has resulted in a sort of impunity for the kingdom from crimes like murdering Khashoggi.
And I would add that these are not really national interests in the sense of interests of the American people. These are the interests of special interest lobbies who bribe politicians. And the Saudis are notorious for lavishing ridiculous amounts of money in often moderately ineffective bribes to American politicians. They're known as the most irresponsible people with money on the face of the earth, and they come here to the United States and throw their money around, and a lot of people catch it. And some of those people are very powerful, and so their interest, it's not the U.S. national interest, again, it's these special interests that want to keep a lucrative relationship going with the Saudis. And then let's not forget that the other big special interest involved in U.S. Middle East policy is, of course, the Zionist entity. And Netanyahu, who is every bit as brutal and vicious as the clown prince of Saudi Arabia, has largely owned the recent American leaders, Trump most obviously, but the Israelis still have tremendous power over the Biden administration, over the Congress, over the U.S. State Department, and much of the apparatus of power here. And Netanyahu and his friends are best buddies with bin Salman. So there are all kinds of extremely powerful, corrupt special interests that are conspiring to let bin Salman get away with murder.
Syrian air defenses have responded to Israeli airstrikes over Damascus. According to Syrian military sources, the Israeli regime conducted several air raids targeting areas around the capital. The aerial attacks were carried out from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. Syrian air defense units intercepted most of the rockets. The Israeli regime regularly violates the Syrian airspace and conducts air raids on the Arab country. Now, thousands of Haitians have taken to the streets of the capital, Port-au-Prince, to demand an end to President Jovenel Moïse's term in office. Protesters called Moïse a dictator supported by the United States, the Organization of American States, and other international organizations such as the UN. Haiti's opposition claims Moïse should step down as his five-year term in office expired on February the 7th following the disputed 2015 election. Moïse rejected those claims, arguing that he took power in February of 2017 after winning the election in 2016 and has pledged to step down next year. Tensions flared recently after the president alleged there was an attempt to overthrow the government and 23 people were arrested. The Venezuelan president says his country will review its relations with Spain after the visit of Spanish foreign minister to Colombia's border regions. From Caracas, here's Jesus Silva.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela might be about to break relations with the Kingdom of Spain after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced he would review relations of all kinds with the European country due to what he calls their improper and disrespectful actions against Venezuela. Experts say that Spain, among members of the European Union, is regarded as the most important influence in the European policy toward the nations of Latin America. In the light of rising political tensions between Caracas and Madrid, Maduro denounced recent hostile actions from the Spanish government of Pedro Sanchez, including the Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha Gonzalez, who last Saturday visited the border between Colombia and Venezuela and criticized the situation of Venezuelan migrants in the zone. The visit by the top Spaniard diplomat in Colombia was strongly decried by Maduro, saying that Spain must stay away from his country's internal issues.
I condemn Spain's meddling actions. Such a mistaken conduct will be punished by my administration.
Meanwhile, on the opposition side, many back the Spanish move, alleging the European country must intervene in Venezuela's problems.
Spain's speaking in favor of Venezuelan migrants who flee our homeland due to Maduro's failed regime.
However, Venezuelan officials insist the Spanish move is politically motivated and therefore will not be tolerated.
Spain and the European Union must rectify their hostile political stance on Venezuela, or else relations will break up.
Maduro has remarked that relations with Spain in all areas will be fully examined by him, as the Spanish meddling in Venezuela's affairs is unacceptable. He blames Madrid over imitating the U.S. hostility and claims Venezuela will respond accordingly.
Now, former U.S. President Donald Trump has hinted at running for the 2024 presidential election, repeating his claims of election fraud in 2020. Take a listen.
Actually, as you know, they just lost the White House, but it's one of those things. But who knows? Who knows? I may even decide to beat them for a third time, okay?
His first public appearance since leaving office, Trump called for election reforms, accusing the Democrats of taking advantage of what he called a corrupt electoral system. He slammed President Joe Biden administration's policies, including the lifting of travel bans, easing limitations on immigration, the U.S. return to the Paris Climate Accord, and Washington's re-engagement with the World Health Organization. Former U.S. president also criticized the current administration's stance toward the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Trump said if he were in office, he would have reached a new agreement with Tehran in a matter of a week. He made the comments during the keynote speech at the annual CPAC conference. Now, France says it'll hold talks with Germany to ease cross-border travel restrictions due to take effect next week.
We want to avoid that for the 16,000 cross-border workers in Moselle, who I insist do not travel for tourism or secondary reasons, but to work on a daily basis. So we don't want this to be stopped. What is normally implemented, to be precise, are PCR tests every day. with extremely strict motives in order to cross the border. We want to ease that.
Germany says it'll impose restrictions on travel from the French border region of Moselle as of Tuesday. Germany's disease control agency has classified that area as one of concern due to the spread of the South African variant of COVID. The French government says borders should remain open between EU countries during the pandemic. Paris clashed with Berlin last year after it closed the border during the first wave of the outbreak in Europe. Kristen Hond in Paris says the South African variant of the coronavirus has spread in France's regions that border Germany because Paris is reluctant to impose a severe restriction.
Well, it's really two different approaches. The German approach, it's the German way, let's say, more severe. They want to impose more, severe restrictions on the northeast of France, which is bordering to Germany. So they want to suspend train traffic and to impose COVID tests in the last 24 hours, which is really severe. The French, which is really more the French way, want more to soften it. And make it more flexible. The real reason behind this is this there is a really important increase of contaminations of the COVID virus of the South African variant. And this happens in the northeast region of Moselle, but also in the northwest Dunkirk and in the southeastern Nice. So a recent regional curfew and lockdown has been imposed recently by the French authorities. And they are very reluctant to impose a nationwide lockdown.
And Iran's Royan Institute has created a transgenic mouse that can be infected with the coronavirus. This is a breakthrough for testing new COVID vaccines, as it allows researchers to study the side effects without direct human trial. Press TV's Youssef Jalali has more.
Lab rats have always been used as guinea pigs for testing brand new medicine. But when it comes to the coronavirus, the story is different. Mice cannot be infected with the coronavirus, since they do not have the receptor that hosts the virus. To scientists, however, there's always a way. Iran's Royan Institute, which specializes in biomedical and stem cell research, has created transgenic mice with a human receptor on their cells. The receptor, called HACE2, is the one that the coronavirus uses to make its way into human cells. This means the genetically modified mice can now catch the virus.
We transferred a human version of this receptor called ACE2 to the mice, and now our transgenic mice can basically get the virus, can get the disease COVID-19, and they are a good model for the basically studies that aim to investigate drugs, medical procedures.
The transgenic mice can be used to understand unexpected clinical manifestations of the coronavirus infection in humans.
It will be useful for those aspects of COVID-19 which are basically more or less unknown right now. And we hope that it will uncover more details about the disease process itself. And also, it will be useful for other possible new types of coronavirus, which may appear in future years.
Experts at Royan Institute say the mice can also be used as a viable stand-in for humans in testing potential vaccines and therapeutics.
Basically, any types of vaccine which is proposed for this specific disease can be used on these mice. So we are providing these mice for other researchers in the country to use it before they try it on human, and they can get more information from the mice, because you can easily dissect mice and see what's happening inside the bodies, the organs. You can't do that with human, right?
Royan Institute is currently developing its own COVID vaccine. The preclinical stages will involve testing the vaccine on the genetically modified mice. Royan's vaccine is one of the 8 jabs Iran is developing. 2 of them have so far made their way to the human trial phase.
Since the virus struck in Iran, Royan Institute has stepped in to join the fight against COVID-19 by mass-producing test kits. And now that its vaccine is lagging behind in the race with its domestic rivals, the leading biotech firm says lab results show that the vaccine is a promising candidate. It will soon enter the animal trial phase. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
That's it for me.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Texas isn't the only U.S. state that allows its residents to choose between energy providers, but a model of energy system that led to the recent power crisis is built upon a shaky framework, says Sharon Zhang, news writer, in an article published under the heading, Texas Power Grid Deregulation Costs Texans $28 billion over two decades. Stay tuned for more. A new analysis by the Wall Street Journal, WSJ, has found that the deregulation and monopolization of the Texas energy market cost Texas residents $28 billion more than they would have paid under a traditional utility. When Texas changed from fully regulated power generation to the largely deregulated system that's in place today, it began requiring almost 60% of residents to buy from retail utilities rather than a public local utility, says WSJ. Retail providers buy energy and then sell it at a fixed rate and essentially acting as a middleman. Texas isn't the only state in the U.S. that allows its residents to choose between energy providers, but a model of energy system that led to last week's power crisis is built upon a shaky framework. Ironically, the deregulatory effort was supposed to make power cheaper for consumers while avoiding federal oversight. When a Republican state senator who helped lead the charge for deregulation of Texas grid in 1990s alongside lobbyists and businesses like Enron unveiled the deregulation bill in 1999, WSJ noted that he said, "If all consumers don't benefit from this, we will have wasted our time and failed our constituency. Competition in the electric industry will benefit Texans by reducing monthly rates," said then-Governor George W. Bush, per WSJ. Deregulation, according to these lawmakers' stated intentions, didn't work as planned. From 2004 to 2019, WSJ found, while the average rate paid by Texas residents getting their electricity from traditional utilities was 8% lower than the average across the U.S., the average rate among retail providers was 13% higher than the nationwide rate. As Bush noted, deregulation was also supposed to allow for more competition, but various mergers have left the state with only two main retail electricity providers. A 2014 report by the Texas Coalition for Affordable Power, TCAP, had similar findings to WSJ. At a time, the organization found that residents in deregulated areas paid $22 billion more than people in regulated areas of Texas. A follow-up report in 2019 by TCAP found that the gap had since narrowed, but that the system has a long way to go, said TCAP's executive director. WSJ's findings are in light of some conservatives doubling down on defending the deregulated energy system in Texas after the crisis began. Last week, former Texas Governor Rick Perry said that Texans would rather face the energy crisis that ballooned into what some called a Hurricane Katrina-scale disaster that faced regulation from the federal government. Governor Greg Abbott, meanwhile, went on Fox to blame the energy crisis on renewable energy, even though the crisis was largely due to natural gas generation failures and attacked the Green New Deal. However, in the wake of the disaster, climate experts have pointed out that the Green New Deal could actually be instrumental in helping to prevent future disasters like this one. The winter storm that knocked out the grid in Texas has been attributed to the climate crisis, since climate change causes unusual and often disastrous weather conditions. Though climate scientists have warned of such changes for many years, many energy regulators continue to largely ignore the effects of the climate crisis, including Texas grid operator. In an interview with Texas Monthly, the president of the state's grid operator said, "We don't have any climate specialists on staff. It remains to be seen how much consumers will end up paying out of pocket for the past week of energy price spikes in the state. But experts are saying that they will likely to be paying more. Some residents who chose to get their energy from wholesale providers were hit with bills of up to $16,000 last week for just a few days' worth of energy use. Others may see a rise in their rates eventually.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and how about contemplating upon the words of wisdom as taught to us by the barometer of faith, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. How strange is this man! He becomes happy when he gains that which he would never miss, and becomes sad when he misses that which he would never catch. Had he thought, he would have realized that everything is planned and his earnings are predestined. He would have also sufficed with the available and would not have gone into the hard.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the great soul of Imam Khomeini. May God bless him. And with me to discuss deeper insights into the character and personality of Imam Khomeini is, of course, my good friend Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, an Islamic scholar and academic. I'd like to welcome him to the program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting.
In previous sessions, we've talked about polarization of the Imam, which meant that, you know, haq and batil, truth and falsehood. If you're on the path of truth, you're bound to have enemies. And we covered that. Now we're moving on to something very interesting. And I think our listeners are going to be a little bit, I don't know, they're going to be sort of half and half about this, but it's a very, it's very interesting what you're about to, what you're about to say to us. But let me begin by saying that in Surah Baqarah, in chapter 2 of the Holy Quran, we have a passage regarding hypocrites, and it's quite lengthy. The Lord God does say a lot about hypocrites. And quite rightly so. It does say in the Holy Quran, from the Holy Quran, that there is a quote that says that when the enemy, the hypocrites, are with the believers, they say, La ilaha illallah, we believe in the one God that you believe. And when they're with their own shaitans, right, because of course Imam Khomeini referred to the U.S. as the great Satan of our time. And when they are with their satans, they say, no, we're with you, which makes a lot of sense, even in the 21st century, because we know that. So, but you're going to turn around and say something entirely different, because, of course, this is in the context of believers that, you know, not all are believers. There are those who simply pay lip service, but really they are with the kuffar. Their hearts and minds and souls are with the kuffar. So I'll let you quite nicely quote from the great Imam, and take us from there. What do you mean by this?
Right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, you know, we were thinking about, okay, so we have these, everybody's excited and there's agreements and everybody's
all
talking.
Sorts of things,
And you know, we've done a program on it as well. You know,
we
analyzed
we
it, you know,
because
agreements are good. Nobody's against talking.
That's just the way we are. That's what we do.
Right. You know, the same kind of line that Imam taught us, which is that you are rational, you talk, you, this is in the context of, you know, people talking and, you know, agreements being made and everybody being
happy.
Yes,
absolutely.
You know, that's all
good. Exciting stuff, yes.
Right? And we've done programs on, we did a program on it, you know, where we analyzed
we
it.
We always analyze the great game.
We're not naysayers,
yes.
We're not, you know.
No, we're not. No, we're not in that business, though. I don't have a crystal ball.
Right. And so the point is that there's this sentence from Imam.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's one of those,
yes,
you know, one of those sentences where you're like, okay, cool, now I get it.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you the basic translation of it. Like, you know, it's not the exact word-for-word translation. Sure. He says, even if America and Israel said, La ilaha illallah,
yes,
we wouldn't believe them.
We wouldn't believe them. Interesting.
Because they just want to want to fool us.
Yes. Because I would have thought, you know, being a believer or being in part of the Muslim Ummah, that would have been a wonderful thing if I heard that America had said La ilaha illallah. Because, you know, on a low-level basis of faith, I would have said, well, you know, they've converted to Islam or something. But you're talking about something entirely different.
Right, which is what another characteristic of Imam, which I want to talk about.
Exactly. Because
we talked about his fearlessness. Remember, before
we
talked about his ability to really distinguish haq from batil, which, you know, if you want to call it polarization, but we would call it something that he really is able to, you know, distinguish haq from batil. Mm. Part of that, or another aspect of that, or even something different from that, is just his ability to distinguish who's a munafiq.
Exactly.
Who's lying?
Who's lying? Who tells us lies?
Who's trying to fool you?
Exactly.
Okay, this is a big problem that we have within believers and religious people. Is, you know, we try to be good, we try to have good,
To do things in good faith.
We try to have good assumptions about people.
People, yes.
And, you know, we'd say, well, you know, they must be good, and yet we see, and you know, you see the same thing with the Prophet, peace be upon him. Again, you see the same thing with the Imam.
Very good.
With Imam Ali alayhi salam, you see it with the Imams.
Yes.
They are able to distinguish the enemy.
Yes.
They are able to distinguish who is trying to fool them. They can distinguish who is, you know, saying things out of nifaq, out of hypocrisy.
Sure. Because it's very interesting what you're saying, because even if we put it in a historical context, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, at all times, try to give the enemy a way out, if I can put it that way.
Okay.
And we had treaties which allowed the kuffar, in a way, to repent, in a way, to find salvation.
Right.
He even said, okay, you don't accept me as a prophet, then fine, just cut out my name from the piece of paper.
The preamble.
The preamble. Thank you. But what happens? We see that down the road, although everything was done in good faith, the other side cannot maintain it. And we realize that because, you know, somewhere down the line, they reneged.
Right.
So basically what you're saying is absolutely true, because there's a precedent for this. And it's true. We have deals. We have things happening. It excites us. Yes, wonderful. But you're right. There is caution.
Right. And it has to do with the fact that a believer...
Mm-hmm.
shouldn't be simple-minded about things.
Exactly.
That's the point.
That's the point.
Okay? Yeah. The point is not that the fact that you're trying to be a good, ethical person doesn't mean that you know, become simple-minded and not realize who the enemy is and who the... And at the same time, because, you know, I mean, I want to be clear about this.
Mm.
You have certain movements. You have this idea of you know, which is now Supreme Leadership, you know, coined the phrase, he said, heroic flexibility. Right, it's not about being, you know, just a, you know, one track stubborn, you know, you have to have flexibility, you have to try to, you know, try to do things in a way that gets you to your goal.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
But at the same time, not be simple minded
about
things. You know, when he talked about the heroic flexibility initially, he used the example of a wrestler. Where, you know, a wrestler might bend and twist in order to what? In order to win the battle.
The battle, yes.
When he's doing this...
Win the competition, yeah.
When he's doing this, he's aware of who is against him. He's not, you know, there for you know, coffee and cake.
No.
Okay?
Yeah.
So I think what I'm trying to point out here is that you have a person like Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Yes.
And then as a successor, Ayatollah Khomeini. And you can see that one of the distinct features of real Islamic leaders, which again, in its greatest manifestation, you see in the Imams and you see in the Prophet, is being able to distinguish, you know, people who are trying to fool you.
Exactly.
Distinguish who the enemy.
Mm.
not being fooled by certain words of the enemy, which might have an emotional appeal to you.
Exactly.
Like you said.
Mm.
Wouldn't it be great? Oh, suddenly, you know,
my God.
Right?
Yeah.
How are they going to try to fool you? They're not going to try to fool you by cursing you.
No.
Right?
Right.
You, when you're trying to get something from somebody, mm. which is not your right, mm. which is whatever, I'm saying, you know, mm. let's just give an example of not you, me. Okay?
Yes, yes.
Well, you try to, you know, ingratiate yourself. You try to do things that they like. You mm. might even, you know,
mm.
you try to be like them.
Yes.
So that they will be like, oh, you're just like me. Okay, here you go.
Yeah.
But it's a lie.
It
it's not real.
Mm.
So there again. And, you know, this is why Imam, you know, this is why he's a great person. This is why he's a great leader.
Mm.
This is why people love him.
Mm.
Is because you have a cleric. A Islamic scholar who's supposed to, you know, be happy when somebody says La ilaha illallah.
Exactly.
Right?
That's a very good point.
You know?
Absolutely.
And he's
absolutely.
Like saying, even if they say the one thing which is the
core
of my belief.
Of my belief, yes.
Of what I'm trying to say, which mm. is Tawheed, which is, you mm. know, there's no God but mm. but Allah. Even if they say that very sentence, which is the core of my being, I'm not going to be fooled by it. And this is a problem that we have among the believers.
We do.
Okay?
Mm.
Is that we get fooled too mm. easily.
Mm.
Okay? Whether it's, you know, the direct enemy that's you know, we're opposing, the one that really doesn't want us to be around, or whether it's, you know, trying to compromise with, you know, whatever.
It's very interesting.
People or movements or groups mm. which, you know, in the end, they really don't believe in what you believe.
Exactly. I'd like to take a small example just to
right.
to take our argument forward. And this is real. This has actually happened.
Mm.
In the UK, mm. at this moment in time, all Muslims are under surveillance. They're under surveillance by MI5 and MI6, the intelligence services of the UK. In what way do they carry out their surveillance? Well, you get a couple of officers, police officers, posing as Muslim converts.
Right.
They go to the mosques. They pick up on some Molana, some scholar, if you like, an imam masjid, who they think is pretty vocal in what he has to say during the Jummah khutbah, during the Friday sermons and stuff. And they pick up on this and they say, well, this guy looks like he could be trouble. So they go over, they say, well, you know, it's very interesting what you have to say and things like that. We love that. And it's very interesting. And they try to build a relationship with this person. And down a few months, they decide that they're going to convert to Islam. And, you know, the Imam Masjid becomes very happy. He says, well, you know, all you have to do is say, La ilaha illallah. And there you have it. And they've got the beards, they've got the silly little cap, and, you know, what we talked about, the caricatures of Muslims. They do that. And you know what happened? 6 months down the line, that Imam Masjid is now in jail. Because they asked him questions like, what's your take on jihad? Do you think it's the right thing to kill British soldiers in Afghanistan? Questions like this. And, of course, you know, his answers didn't go down too well with those officers. So they persecuted the family. They actually built up a huge case. It went to the Old Bailey. And the guy's now facing, I think, it's like a 10-year prison sentence. Or
right.
maybe even he's probably off to Gitmo. So, you know, this is the thing. So what you're really seeing there is very, very, very powerful, because the Imam, may God bless his soul, is really pointing us out. Don't be naive of the enemy.
Don't be naive. Don't be naive.
And that's a real example.
Right. And it's not about that, you know, somebody who has, you know, has good assumptions about other people is a bad person.
Yes.
It's just there's a difference between, you know, that and somebody who is a leader of a community.
Mm.
Or somebody who has a responsibility for others being naive.
Yes.
If you're just in your own life and you don't have family and kids and you're just living your... you're living in your own little, you know...
Yeah.
apartment somewhere and have nothing to do with people, whatever. I mean, okay, maybe your naivete is just going to harm you.
Yes.
But the point is, when you have, you know, governments, when you have, you know, societies, when you have Muslims who have responsibility for others, they can't be naive. They can't. And, you know, I'll give you another example.
Please.
Because we've talked about this.
Yes.
The Turkish leaders.
Yeah, so...
Okay?
Yeah, so we haven't spoken about
like,
them.
It's not like, you know, Hillary came and said, La ilaha illallah, but, you know...
Yeah, she was close to it.
Right. Right, so I mean, It's like, just use your brain.
I know.
You know, all this history and all these things, because, you know, we recently had the Supreme Leader, you know, mentioning, giving us a little short history of what America has done in the region and to Iran.
Sure.
You know, just to balance things out a little.
Yes,
of,
I mean,
know,
he did point out that they actually slaughtered something like 4 million natives.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about also even...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah, that is a whole... Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
That,
I mean, for goodness sake, let's
that's its own story.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get things into perspective.
What they did in their own so-called, you know, so-called own country.
Own country, and inverted commas.
Right. But, you know, why would you believe a government, people, you know, statesmen, stateswomen from, you know, America, Britain, France, you know, Israel, with that history? And you read the Quran.
Absolutely.
Okay, like, you know,
yeah, it's crazy.
You've read the Quran. I know you've read the Quran.
Yeah. What did you get out of it?
Dr. Davutoglu, I know you've read the Quran, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
but, you know,
did you understand?
Did you understand anything of it?
Right?
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it?
Why would you rely on the Americans? Okay? And worst of all, because you know, we're like, so what do we do about, you know, cuz that's clear. And you know, it's not simply munafiq. It's not simply an issue of being munafiq.
No.
They're not munafiq. They're not saying
yeah.
You know, they're not saying we're Muslim, you know.
No.
What I'm trying to point out is that, you know, this sentence by Imam, again, you know, even if America, if America and Israel, even if they said La ilaha illallah, we wouldn't believe.
Believe
it. You know, don't be swayed by these emotional, you know, actions of other people. Use your brain, step back for a second, think about the essence of the of who's opposite you. Think about their nature. Think about their history.
It's very important.
Okay? Think about who is standing in front of you. You know, don't get caught up. This is how Shaitan, you know...
Does his work.
Fools you.
Fools you. That's exactly what
okay?
he does.
You go that line, which is the line, you know, the Sirat al-Mustaqim. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to curse them immediately right there in front of them. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, behave in an irrational manner or in a rude manner, even to the enemy. Just know who the enemy is.
Exactly.
So, you know, I just wanted to point that out about Imam, that very, very precise understanding of who the enemy is. This is on, as it relates to enemies, you know, outside of the Islamic world or of the Muslims or even outside Iran.
Sure.
Another example of what we're talking about
and
what I'm talking about is how he was able to understand those people within the revolutionary movement who were a danger.
Very good
and
point.
Who might have said La ilaha illallah.
Of course.
But who didn't believe it.
No.
The greatest example being Munafiqeen organization.
Exactly. Because they were looking for their own benefit and their own power in the country.
They were using Islam as a tool.
A tool to get to where they wanted to get.
To, you know, play with the emotions of people who are religious. But in reality, it was just a cult.
It was
like, you know, let's just have these two people. I don't even want to mention their names.
No.
Okay, because...
No, it's not.
They're
worth
just,
it.
They're, you know.
No.
They're not worthy of.
Yeah, I can see their images just
it's
now.
Not even,
no.
They're not even worthy of being mentioned.
No mention, yeah.
Right? Mm. And it's basically, you know, brainwashed cult.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
And from the very. We're talking, you know, way before the revolution, where the revolutionary movements had begun, you know, in the 60s.
Sure.
You had these efforts by these groups like Munafiqeen and others to try to get some sort of, you know, some sort of credibility by being associated with Imam.
Yes, exactly. And to become popular.
Right.
And a populist
through
movement.
Through their, you know, get a kind of quote-unquote blessing from Imam.
Imam, yes.
And he refused to give it to them.
Yes, because he knew their nature.
He knew that they were not
what
Muslim.
They say they are.
They were not La ilaha. They didn't believe in La ilaha illallah. When they said La ilaha, they didn't believe it. This is why they're called Munafiqeen.
Exactly. That's the whole point, isn't it?
Right?
This is what we were referring to in Surah Baqarah.
Okay.
That's the whole point. Yes.
Because they asked him, you know, in the 60s, are we allowed to give of our homes to certain movements in the revolutionary struggle? And he forbid it.
He forbid it.
He said, don't give it to them.
No, no, no.
They're not, their goal is not Islam.
Islam.
Okay.
Mashallah.
That's on the left and on the Marxist or whatever.
Yeah,
wanna,
they were.
On
I mean,
that
we found out later
on the more liberal side of things, he stood firmly against, and we've mentioned this before, those organizations which had the claim or the mantle of religiosity, you know, the nationalist religious groups, the freedom movement, whatever, you know, who came from a liberal even a certain, to a certain extent, conservative social background, you know, middle class, upper class,
sure,
who basically were trying to go that kind of liberal conservative Western model for Iran.
Yes, exactly.
Not the Marxist model.
No, the
so
Western
and they said, well, you know, as Iranians, we are also Muslim, and you know, we pray and whatever and all that. Okay,
yeah.
So it's not like they were not, you know,
practicing Muslims,
right?
Or religious,
but they were extremely naive.
They were
in the sense of like, well, let's try to come to a deal with the Americans. You know, at the time of the revolution, it's
That's
not
right.
even the, it's not even now when we're powerful,
yes, I know.
And where we have, you know, where we have 100 things that have happened in these 35 years that
yes.
give us the ability to go sit there for, you know, months on end and negotiate and come to a deal that
sure.
that we like and that benefits us to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
It's at that time when we were just passed through being their slaves, and now suddenly they're like, well, you know, let's so. And you see Imam standing very firmly saying, even though that you are Muslims and you say La ilaha illallah, and again, we mentioned this example in the previous program, the issue came about Islamic laws.
Yes.
Especially as it
That's
relates...
That's right, we mentioned this before.
Especially as it relates to criminal offenses.
Yes, yes.
Being implemented.
Mm.
Which, you know, that's what you do in an Islamic government.
Exactly,
you know,
exactly.
That's part of Islam. You can't, you know, pick and choose.
Choose, exactly.
You know, I like the prayer part. I don't like the part about executing, you know, a person who's killed, you know, a whole family.
Yeah.
So that's part of Islamic law as well.
Exactly.
You can't pick and choose it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There's even ayat in the Quran talking about you take one part of the Quran and
yes,
you take,
exactly,
take the other.
And choose another. You're going to do like what Bani Israel did before?
Right.
Yeah.
So a lot of Muslims do that, unfortunately.
I know they do.
And I'm not saying, maybe I do it myself as well. I don't know. I'm just saying that you're not supposed to do that. Okay?
Sure.
The point is, so the minute you have these people who, you know, pray, fast,
mm-hmm.
all the things,
fine.
And then they're like, oh, if we do Islamic laws as it relates to criminal offenses, this will be against the Charter of Human Rights, Human Rights Charter of the UN.
Mm-hmm.
You know what Imam said. He said anybody who denies hudud, qasas,
hudud,
the
is a kafir.
Is a kafir. Is a kafir.
Mm.
They say La ilaha illallah, they pray.
Yeah,
says
yeah.
Anybody who denies this aspect of Islam is like denying all of Islam. So, why are you denying that part of it?
Mm.
Why are
it's
you
a very
saying,
interesting question.
Right? So, again, not all enemies are the same. Not all people whose final agenda is not Islam are going to
yes,
approach it in a certain manner. You have people who have a lesser degree of issues, who have greater degrees
degree
of problems
issues,
and,
yes.
and issues in their conduct and in their beliefs.
Sure.
So it doesn't mean that you treat all of them exactly the same way. It doesn't mean that your reaction to them is all the same.
And you have to be very sophisticated in how
but
you
But you have to understand who the enemy is.
Is.
And you have to understand...
At all levels.
And you have to understand who it is that really wants Islam as the goal.
Exactly.
And not just any Islam, the Islam of their nafs.
Uh-huh.
It's the Islam of Ahlul Bayt.
Because remember, this is very interesting because this does go back to something we've spoken about previously. That, you know, it was very interesting how Imam, and God bless his great soul, honestly, I mean, I was thrown by this all the time in the Western press, that he talked about, you know, Muhammadan Islam, and then he talked about American Islam.
Exactly.
And I couldn't figure out what he meant. America, I mean, America, you know...
Right.
If you know anything about America, you can't associate the word Islam with it. But, you know, he said that there's
Listen,
two different types.
He said it at some point
yeah.
and places. He said they want an Islam in which there's no jihad, where there's no qasas.
It's like half
you know,
all the
where,
stuff is
where
out.
All those issues relating to you know, marital relations and ethical matters that it relates to the relationship between
yeah,
man
just
and
having
women
a wee wash
and family and all that are all out of it. That's
yes.
the kind of Islam they want.
Yes. Which basically means you just
you know,
chuck it away.
Right. So he's saying that this, you know, it's not even his opinion. He's saying in the Quran says you can't.
You can't.
It's a package.
Yeah.
It's a package deal.
It's throwing the baby out of the bathwater.
It's a package
it?
Deal.
Hmm.
It's all or nothing.
It's all or nothing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, all or nothing, not in the sense that we are able to implement everything in our lives. We have different capacities.
Capacities, yes.
You know, there's a very big, you know that Islamic, according to Islamic law, this is a very important point, and I really would like our listeners to really pay attention to this.
Please,
there's
please.
A big, big difference.
Mm.
There's a world of difference,
mm.
according to Islamic law, between somebody who says, let me just, there's two kind of people I'm going to mention.
Please.
The first person says, I don't deny Islamic law. I don't deny that there is prayer five times. I don't deny that there is fasting during the month of Ramadan, etc., etc., etc. But I am not, I don't have the power to do it, or I'm not capable of doing it.
That's true.
There's a difference between a person who says this and a person who says, no, there is no prayer. I believe in God, but there really isn't. This was just something that was in the Quran, you know, whatever, or you guys made it up from the Rivayat.
Yes, sure.
Or, you know, whatever. The fasting, no, there is God, the Prophet was... But, you know, this fasting thing, well, this was in the old days when people didn't have doctors, and you know, this kind of stuff that we hear. There's a world of difference between these two.
Two people, yes.
The first one, no problem.
No problem. No.
It really...
No.
The only problem that person has is with himself and God.
With his God,
He's not denying it.
He's not denying anything. Absolutely.
He's just saying, I'm
wonderful.
Weak. I can't do it. Or, you know...
Yeah, there's some difficulty.
Right. You know, this is completely different than somebody who's going to deny the essence of it. Even though they might say, you know, la ilaha illallah.
But that's the whole point, isn't it? This is the point that we're arriving at.
It's not about saying it.
No.
Only. It's about the consequences.
Consequences of what's being said. Mm.
So when he says, you know, I believe in God. Of course there's a God. Because, you know, you hear this. They're like, of course there's God. You know, who's very few people actually deny
God.
Right, you know?
Yeah, I think since the outset of humanity, they haven't denied. Right. Even
we're talking about in Islamic communities and societies.
Absolutely.
Very few people will
deny that.
Or say, no, the Prophet wasn't the Prophet. It's when it comes to the consequences of saying, La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah.
Wonderful.
You know,
this is
that's what it comes down to,
and that's what the imams are referring to exactly.
Right. So here we have,
rahmatullahi,
we have Imam Khomeini, as we mentioned previously,
fearless. I know,
and you know, really fearless, not like show fearless and showing off.
Brave as because he's from Imam Ali. Let me see.
Right.
You know, I mean, come on, let's get things into perspective.
Number one, number two, completely. Distinguishing haq from batil without any sort of, you know, wishy-washiness.
Wishy-washiness. Thank you.
Okay? No wishy-washiness.
No wishy-washiness.
Okay? Because we have that in the culture and we have that
among
the
we've seen it for the last 1,400
and
years.
And it's, you know, it's a kind of creeping way of nifaq. It's a kind of creeping nifaq.
It is. It's a creeping nifaq. Very nicely put. It's an engineering term. I can see it now. Creeping nifaq. I can do a formula for that.
Exactly.
Yes, thank
Please
you.
Figure out the formula.
I will. I'll let you know.
Nifaq.
I certainly will let you know on this program.
The third thing we're mentioning now is the fact that he was very keen and, how should I say it, he was very precise and very exact and very capable of distinguishing the enemy, distinguishing who is trying to fool him and who is really being honest and sincere.
Exactly.
With the sentence that we mentioned, which is that even if Israel and even if America and Israel say La ilaha illallah, we won't believe them.
Exactly.
Because they're trying to fool us.
Fool us.
Okay? And what we're trying to say here is that this relates to you as a Muslim individually and as a community, as it relates to outside enemies
Absolutely.
That are clear,
mm-hmm.
and as it relates to nifaq within the Muslim community. There are, you know, that's the whole point of a Muslim.
This is the greatest danger that we as believers
right?
face.
Right? Because obviously being within the Islamic community means you've said La ilaha illallah Muhammadan Rasulullah. Right? So the point is, you know, who's being honest?
Who's being honest?
Who's accepting?
Who's sincere in terms
who's
of
being,
his
who's accepting the consequences
That's
of that?
Exactly.
Okay, and we see in the history of Imam and in what he did, Imam Khomeini, you had people within the revolutionary movement, within the so-called Islamic tent, and they were saying it, and yet they were after the opposite. And he was able to distinguish them. At a time when people were like, well, you know, we have the Shah as the enemy. Well, let's not, you know, why are you being so? And he's like, no, he could see the result of what they're saying, you know, 30 years down the road.
Exactly.
Because he understood Islam, because he was a student of Quran. And in the Quran, it teaches you all these things.
Wonderful.
Okay? If you read the Quran and not just read it as a... As hips or as trying to just parrot-wise, you know? Parrot-like fashion.
No.
Where you actually
that
ponder...
That Hivs is living it.
Right. It's the pondering on it, the thinking about it, the you know, it going into your soul and it becoming something that then you use in your life.
Exactly.
In order to be able to distinguish the issues and the challenges.
The truth and false.
Right? This is where Imam comes from.
Exactly.
And this is where we have to also try to get ourselves and to come from that position as well.
Dr. Mati Tarabi, thank you very much.